This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Good Austrian work is particularly hard to understand. The truth it expresses never leans towards plausibility. He was referring to specific Austrian writers and composers of his times, but what he meant can easily be applied to Wittgenstein himself. Wittgenstein is particularly hard to understand, and he was hardly understood at all, at least according to his own assessment, by some of his most famous contemporary philosopher colleagues. At the same time, Wittgenstein is particularly easy to understand. Many of his aphorism-like sentences and remarks seem quite accessible, often humorous, even poetic, sometimes mysterious, sometimes melancholic, never boring. In short, enjoyable also to the non-philosophical reader. There is even sometimes a certain honest, almost anti-philosophical connotation to his remarks when he, for example, says, "A philosophical problem has the form, I don't know my way about." He often leaves the reader with the feeling that he wrote his philosophy in order to liberate mankind from all philosophy, by solving all philosophical problems, but then only in order to admit that once we arrive at that stage, the real problems of life are not even touched at all. Wittgenstein's most often quoted sentences, such as "the limits of my language are the limits of my world," or "whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent," have assumed a certain life of themselves and are often quoted out of context, as if they were great lines of great poems, rather than one piece in a carefully constructed line of thought. In Austria, with its traditional anti-philosophical and anti-metaphysical bias, Wittgenstein has impacted writers and poets like hardly any other philosopher at any point of time. If you just take two of the most important authors after the Second World War, Ingeborg Bachmann and Thomas Bernhard, you will find that their poetry and prose is full of references to Wittgenstein. They also both openly claim to be admirers of the philosopher. Tonight, we have a great panel here, which will look at the lasting fascination writers, poets, maybe artists in general, have and always had, not only in Austria, but around the world, with Ludwig Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein's voice is therefore an attempt not only to understand Wittgenstein's philosophy, but to understand the liberating and inspirational impact his philosophy had on artists, particularly those who deal with language, by putting their attention, and therefore also our attention, on the mystery of language itself. I want to thank the distinguished panelists, Marjorie Perloff, Thomas Pepper, Cici Tax, and Rosemary Waldrop, for having agreed to come here and discuss this issue. Some of you have come from very far away to be part of this, and I would like to thank, in particular, Jean-Michel Rabaté, a great philosopher, and through our co-organizer, Slot Foundation in Philadelphia, also a great friend of the Austrian Cultural Forum, for having agreed to moderate this event. I want to also thank Cici Tax, who had the original idea to this event, particularly also for the preparatory work she invested into this project, and the Dietrich Botstieber Foundation, who through their financial support has made this event possible. I would also like to thank you in the audience for your continued interest in our program. I wish you an enjoyable evening at the Austrian Cultural Forum, and I now pass on to Jean-Michel. Good evening.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, Martin. Thank you, Andreas, for organizing this. It's my pleasure to moderate the panel tonight. I'll begin by introducing the speakers. Each of them will present a short statement of something like 5 minutes, after which we'll have a rapid discussion and we'll open it to the floor. I'll introduce the speakers in the order of their presentations. First, Marjorie Perloff, the Sadie Dunham Patek Professor of Humanities at Stanford. Her work has been concerned with explicating the writings of experimental and avant-garde poets relating to the major currents of modernist and postmodernist activity. Her books would be too numerous to list. I'll just quote Differentials, The Vienna Paradox, Poetry on and Off the Page, Wittgenstein's Letter, which is more or less the book that concerns our debate tonight, and many others, A Futurist Moment, and so on. The second speaker will be Cici Tax, who is a poet and has a PhD in literature from Graz University. Her prose trilogy, Manchmal immer, Je nachdem und so fort, was published by Droschel Verlag, Graz. She served on the editorial team of the literary journal Manuskripte in the 70s. From 1986 to 1988, she was the deputy director of the Literaturhaus in Berlin. She's a member of the Graz Authors Assembly and won the Hofer-Tunzer Prize in 2001, lectures regularly on literature and film. And she's currently working on a translation of Wittgenstein's Mistress by David Markson, one of the books we all read for this discussion. She is nicknamed the Love Doctor and has been living in Berlin since 1982. Tom Pepper is an associate professor in the Department of Cultural Studies and Comparative Literature at the University of Minnesota. His primary research interests are the histories of Western philosophy and of psychoanalysis. He spent his German Chancellor Fellowship year at the Freie Universität Berlin and Universität Freiburg. He is the author of a number of books, Singularities, edited the Yale French Studies on Blanchot, edited Dreams of Interpretation, and is currently working on a book called In the Meantime. And finally, Rosemary Waldrop, most of you here know her, was born in Germany in 1935. She's a poet, translator, small press publisher, and earlier has taught comparative literature at Wesleyan, Tufts, and Brown universities. Recent books are Curves to the Apple, Dissonance, collected essays, and she has translated from the French Edmond Jabès, Jacques Roubaud, Emmanuel Hocquart, from the German Friederike Mayröcker, Ernst Jandl, Elke Erb, Oscar Pasteur, Gerhard Ruhm, Ulf Stolferfurt, and Peter Waterhouse. So, having said this, I will let Marjorie begin, since I mentioned this Wittgenstein ladder. Marjorie will present a few points just to begin the discussion.
Thank you, Jean-Michel. Delighted to be here. We're all delighted to be here. And I think we're going to have a few rounds and then obviously open to the floor. There's so many people in the audience who know a great deal about Wittgenstein. There are really two points I want to make, just for starters, partly which are in the book, but just to refine them in certain ways. The reason Wittgenstein is so irreplaceable for poets and artists, aside from anything else, but really, is that his basic theory is that there are no thoughts outside of language, if we can make it that simple, which of course is a simplification. But it's so amazing how profound that is. There are no thoughts outside of language. There aren't ideas that you then express in language. There is language. And once you have that view, then every word, even the smallest words, or rather sentences, because Wittgenstein doesn't think in terms of words. He rejects that view explicitly, but in terms of sentences. And throughout his career, he kept refining this idea so that you come to the book on certainty, which is one I actually didn't talk about much in Wittgenstein's Ladder, and you get those wonderful pseudo-dialogues where one person is asking another, have you ever been to China? And if the person says, I don't know, which, of course, infuriated Wittgenstein, to say that, he'll say, what could that mean, to say, I don't know? It means your mother maybe was pregnant and she was on the border, but she isn't sure she was in China, so you don't know whether you were in China, that you may have been born in China. How could you possibly say, I don't know? What does it mean to say, I don't know, in that context? And always, you know, the most simple, seemingly common sense things that trip us all up until you start thinking about them. My favorite is also the one about a dog is said to wait for his master, but he can't be said to wait for his master to come on Wednesday. And, you know, I feel so strongly about those statements, like if a lion could speak, we would not understand him, that when I get all these invitations now or things for animal studies, and they mention who the speakers are, I always write to I really wrote to the moderator at Stanford, and I said, have you invited any animals? I mean, you know, because, I mean, then why can't they speak for themselves? I mean, what is that going to mean, really? And so Wittgenstein would take nothing for granted. He's the great philosopher who would take nothing for granted, so that you have to look at that sentence sentence and think what it could mean in various contexts. The famous example in the investigations of the chess game, where what does it mean to say this is the king, this is the queen? And Wittgenstein has the most elaborate, absurd, almost surreal examples of what it might mean. Well, I know different chess sets, but I've never seen an Iranian chess set, so I don't know which are the king and the queen. You know, you can play all these games. And of course, it therefore is so close to the writing of people like Beckett, for instance, and Watt, where you have dialogues that almost seem to come straight out of Wittgenstein. So the fact that the most common nouns like color, pain, name, read, know, have no meaning outside the context makes you very suspicious of non-contextual assertions. And it helps tremendously not only in literature but in politics. You never can listen to, at least I can't listen to Wolf Blitzer or listen to any of those people on CNN and hear those statements and think, what is that really saying? There's no context there. If you really looked at the context, you would understand it in a very different way. So it changes your thinking. Wittgenstein changes your thinking, I think, forever. And then he does not feel that therefore we don't communicate. On the contrary, most of the time we communicate quite well. If I say pass the sugar and you're a native speaker and the sugar is sitting there, you'll pass the sugar or not, but you understand very well what I mean. But there are many other cases where meaning is very mysterious. And the whole idea, for instance, that you don't ask yourself questions like, do I have 2 feet? You know you do. You don't have to look down to see whether you do or not. So all those things become wonderful puzzles. And the other thing I want to raise is the whole issue of how I would argue, and I know there'll be controversy about this, that Wittgenstein is himself best understood in many ways as a poet. Die Philosophie sollte man eigentlich nur dichten, which the best translation I've seen of that so far is by David, South African Shakespearean, Schalwick. I never can pronounce his name right, but he was also at the Wittgenstein Conference in Kirchberg this summer, who says the best way maybe to translate that is the only way to write philosophy is as if you were writing poetry, because you can't really translate dichten. There is no adequate translation for that word. But what Wittgenstein means, I think, and he deals with it and grapples with it all the time, is that it's a process, it's a processive kind of thing. He was never satisfied. He says both in the preface to the Tractatus and in the preface to the Investigations that he's not satisfied with what he's done. And we know as a fact that then he always continued working. And when he finished the Investigations and was published posthumously, he kept right on going and was already making changes, because his whole way of working was a method, not a theory. And it was a processive thing, and therefore he was very much concerned with structure. If you study Wittgenstein's rhetoric, which I did for my paper this August in Kirchberg, you find that the earlier on, there are all the aphorisms, like the world of the happy is a happy world. Those are refigured 20 times, just as a poet would. The world of the happy is not the world of the unhappy, and he keeps changing them. And he'll change one word and change it again. He's never quite satisfied, but it's the process of working on it that really matters. In the later work, the aphorisms tend to disappear in favor of elaborate language games, rhetorical games, questions, exclamations, repetitions, where the way the paragraph is framed and put together is a very poetic strategy, and there's never any closure, which makes it quite poetic. There are no answers, there are only questions, and there's only method. And that's often very hard for people to take. I've had a lot of friends who've said, well, all this stuff about pass the slab and so on, I mean, what am I really learning? I mean, what do I underline here? What's the theory? It's not a theory in that way. It's a way of thinking. And in that way, it continues right to his death. And there are always further formulations, as I say. Some of the best come late in the book on certainty, which is not a book that Wittgenstein saw through the press or even expected to have published as a book. But the people in Bergen who are working on the Nachlass now, which is enormous, are having there's some wonderful books coming out of the work in Bergen that people have sent to me, mostly in German, that really do deal with these poetic aspects of framing things just the way you would frame a poem in a way, and then proceeding, and then asking a question again, and then refining a little bit further, and then having everything there, like juggling balls, but there's never any conclusion. And I think I'll just stop right there for now, and we can go on with that later.
Okay. First, I want to say thank you, Martin Rauchbauer, who did invent this event here. And I want to say Thomas Pepper and John Waltermouth for helping me translating my, in my eyes, untranslatable sentences. Since I'm not a native English speaker, I read just what I did for the colleagues to read, so you have an idea, because written stuff is different to spoken stuff. Two moments of focus of interest in relation with wit and voice. A form can't be described, but only presented. In German it is, das kann ich sagen auf Deutsch noch, also a form can't be described, but only presented. Eine Form kann nicht beschrieben werden, sondern nur dargestellt. That's Wittgenstein as a motto. Und ein zweites Motto, a sentence is not emotional. A paragraph is. This is Gertrude Stein. David Markson's novel, Wittgenstein's Mistress, written in one-sentence paragraphs, evinces a structural affinity with the notebooks of the late Wittgenstein. The expression elective affinity occurs to me here. Namely, the structural affinity, namely, the expose of a manner of thinking is practiced in very different ways. Wittgenstein's Mistress, in Wittgenstein's Mistress, the eye is offered as a representation, whereas in Wittgenstein, language itself is thus mobilized, if this can be said at all. In the case of fiction, the I, the narrator, is female, a painter, the last survivor in the world. In the case of the philosophical remarks, the I is male, a philosopher, a man of modernity. As funny as it is abyssal, but also precarious, the similarity between the narrative poetics and the philosophical experiment to bring the concept of experiment for once into play here is indicated by and in my montage of the following two sentences, one from each text. Wittgenstein, the folds of my heart always want to stick back together, and in order to open it, it would always have to tear them apart yet again. In the little folder you find here, you find another translation of this sentence. Die Falten meines Herzens wollen immer zusammenkleben, aber um sie zu öffnen, müsste ich sie immer wieder auseinanderreißen. Und jetzt David Markson. There is a distinction to be made between this sort of depression and the depression I generally felt while I was doing all of that looking. By the way, the latter having been much more decidedly a kind of anxiety. With this small example of the juxtaposition of two different genres of writing and of the syntactical difference of the two languages, English and German, the difference between fiction and philosophy should not be erased. A meditation, a reflection stimulated on the difference and similarity of literary and philosophical writing practices is more the point. On a second area of my focus of interest, especially in the case of the translator, is the problem of translation, which becomes evident in the process of translating, where Wittgenstein's use of language resists reformulation. The question of translatability in Wittgenstein's case is always a question of semantics. Die Philosophie sollte man eigentlich nur dichten. Marjorie Perloff just made a quote of that in a different, and the translation you think is very good. So please repeat it then again, because
philosophy should really only be written as one would write poetry.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't know.
That's David Challis.
Yeah, yeah. What I will bring as an example here is the word dichten. In German you have verdichten, erdichten, umdichten, andichten, which is not possible in English. But now this last passage of my little thing here is translated by Tom Pepper, who his voice is in this translation. What I will bring as an example here is the word dichten as a part of speech with a temporal valence, a verb, dichten. To poetize is a word invented or reinvented, it doesn't matter, doesn't exist. Dichten doesn't exist in the English language. Likewise, the members of its material constellation. Andichten, to impute or attribute to. Erdichten, to fictionalize. But, yeah, to fictionalize. Undichten, to poetically transpose or poeticize around. And verdichten, to condense into a more concentrated essence, but which also has a similarity, as my friend Thomas Pepper reminds me, is the expression Kühlschrankdichtung, insulation for condensation, for refrigeration, and which, as he also reminds me, has now been entirely accidentally literalized by the invention. In Minneapolis, of the magnetic poetry kit for poeticizing with magnetized words on the refrigerator. So, English does not allow you to say to poet. Corresponding terms must be found, poeticized form of poetry, poetic composition, etc. What with this points out and highlights is the hanging together in relation of understanding, misunderstanding, interpretation by pointing to and in pointing out, Deutung and theoretical work, to track all of this would indeed be a matter of huge and necessary and important work. Okay, thank you.
I would like not to read my text as such, but just to use it to make a very few points. There is an epigraph to the Philosophical Investigations, which goes like this. Überhaupt hat der Fortschritt das an sich, dass viel größer ausschaut, als wirklich ist. Nestroy in block capital letters. Or in my English, overall, progress has this about it in itself, that it looks much greater than it really is. Nestroy. Now, this epigraph must be borne in mind as a piece of what we literary critics call paratext, but epigraph is good enough. Whenever one reads a book, and I agree entirely with the idea that Wittgenstein was not, after the Tractatus, a writer of doctrine or of Lehre in the German sense, but I would disagree furthermore about his being, therefore, a thinker of method. I think of him more as a thinker of a way of being on the way, whereas I think of method as something itself deriving more from a question of doctrine. You have a doctrine and then a method of executing it, verifying it, disqualifying it, whatever. I think that there's a slight disagreement going on between Sisi and Marjorie regarding the question of Dichten and Denken, whether Wittgenstein is a poet, as Marjorie maintains, or whether he is a thinker against which must be juxtaposed the activity of the Dichter, the one who poetizes, as Sisi says. Because I think while I agree that distinctions must be maintained and everything is not to be reduced to the one color, Wittgenstein's moment, as it were, is that he belongs precisely to the moment at which philosophy, which had always thought about language and its language, began to do so in a positive manner and to make fundamental explorations of its own language and of language without, in a certain sense, repressing them. And therefore, I think it's possible not simply to mediate between these two positions or to collapse them, but to make them stand in relationship to each other. There is no Wittgenstein I, as is so commonly thought about the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, or Wittgenstein II or III. Wittgenstein himself wished the investigations to be published together with the Tractatus, which was done in German and sometimes in French, but has never been done in English. The fact that most people who read Wittgenstein English do not even know this should make it impossible for them to write so much about him. To him, both of these major works were to be taken as two sides of a coin, two auseinandergesetzt or reciprocally confronting kinds of work. Quote, work generates other kinds of work, unquote, as Richard Serra said recently in an interview. From the crystalline, sovereign, hierarchical steel of the Tractatus, there comes, after more than a decade of teaching, the quote-unquote rough ground, that's from the preface to the Philosophical Investigations, of the flowing, branching, serial composition of the numbered remarks of the first part of the Philosophical Investigations, and then the kinds of sets of comments for which we should have enough of something counting as an original, which is not concerned with language games, the often touted cliche of the concern of the Philosophical Investigations, but with something more like what one teacher of mine calls seeing as, veins into which the last writings pumped out on the philosophy of psychology and the inner and the outer also flow. The problem of entrusting the work, that is to say, the actual corpus of a thinker like Wittgenstein to the philosophers, is that philosophers tend, by pre-Wittgensteinian ways, to be concerned with doctrine and with method. And unfortunately, this has played itself out in the terrible state of the fact that we have no critical edition of Wittgenstein's work, no responsible philological edition. We have a group of people who don't speak to each other, or groups of people who don't speak to each other all over the world doing different pieces of critical editions. This has left us in a situation where, in fact, the executors of Wittgenstein himself tell us that some of his manuscripts have been abhanden gekommen. Reminds me of the poem of the first of the Mahler Rückertlieder, Ich bin der Welt abhanden gekommen, that is to say, lost. This is truly incredible, and in this sense, one must allow those of us who care for texts, critics, philologists, people who deal with words, before we necessarily deal with ideas, to have a foot in the door in treating Wittgenstein's text, which has not been so well dealt with by its philosophical, shall we say, inheritors. But I do want to insist that the change from 1920, around the time of the publication and final composition of the Tractatus, to 1951, Wittgenstein's death, is a set of groupings, tendencies, and so on. And I wish to argue and assert that one of the main things that helped or influenced Wittgenstein along this path, as I've characterized it, was teaching. There was the experience of teaching in the province of the provinces of impoverished rural Austria in the 1920s, where Wittgenstein, who had such trouble getting both of the books he published during his lifetime into print, dictated his second book, his vocabulary book for people's schools. And then from 1929 on, there is the teaching in Cambridge. In his courses at Cambridge, Wittgenstein also dictated, sitting famously in a transatlantic slung chair, very often looking at the ceiling, to students who were situated in similar chairs around him. This is interesting in the case of texts, such as the Philosophical Investigations, which include so many other forms than that of the simple assertoric Satz, or sentence, such as the exclamation, the rhetorical question, the short dialogue, the ellipsis, and so on. Wittgenstein had, as we know, tried to teach the Tractatus as doctrine to at least two friends, the great economic theorist of price, Piero Straffa, and his student, Norman Malcolm, as doctrine. Both experiences left him frustrated and puzzled, and in the case of Straffa, changed. To my knowledge, no one before me, here and now, has ever spoken of the origins of the Philosophical Investigations as a title, Philosophische Untersuchungen, which tells an exemplary parable of the transformation called between the Tractatus and the Investigations. In 1840, Friedrich Adolf Trendelenburg published a book called Logische Untersuchungen, Logical Investigations, which was signally read both by Kierkegaard, who produced existence out of being, and Frege, who produced the existential quantifier, there exists at least one X, in addition to the ancient universal qualifier for all X. In 1899-1900, Husserl produced the massive work of his own logical investigations, Logische Untersuchungen. Husserl read Kierkegaard avidly, was ruthlessly criticized by Frege, and Frege himself, of whom Wittgenstein says of their encounter in Jena in 1909, he wiped the floor with me, put in his will three of his own essays into a posthumous book called Logische Untersuchungen, Logical Investigations, after his death in the mid-20s. Doesn't it say a great deal that, given a lineage he knew so well, Wittgenstein called his posthumous work Philosophical Investigations, not Logical Investigations? This gesture, heretofore unremarked, certainly would indicate that the philosophical is not entirely subtended by the logical. That is why things have to be taught. You can't just send someone home with the textbook and expect them to understand everything of the world. As Wittgenstein puts it early in the Tractatus, quote, the facts in logical space are the world, unquote. What an ironic commentary on the Anglo-Saxon tradition of reading Wittgenstein with its sad and merciless Cold War strength in the wiping of the history of philosophy out of philosophy curricula in the vast majority of advanced programs of philosophy to this very day, which is why Stanley Cavell refers to Anglo-American philosophy as the desert, and why I myself went on to study comparative literature and not philosophy, because I didn't want someone to dictate to me what was philosophy and what was not a worthy object of study. In other words, as Wittgenstein spread out from logic as the essence of philosophy to realizing that philosophy in its essence was much more than just logic, his institutionalization in the Anglophone world went in precisely the opposite direction, very, very sadly, and to the detriment of Wittgenstein studies for decades and continuing. Well, what, and this is a question, demands to be thought every day, at every instant, before, during, and after every pause for breath in the phrase I have referred to from the preface to the Philosophical Investigations, the darkness of this time, the meantime. I have been thinking about this since I first read Wittgenstein at 16 in 1979, which was the most important intellectual encounter of my life. What needs to be said, among so much else, but this is the first thing that comes to mind, is, having quite neatly laid out the rules for the correct form of every sentence which can be asserted in the true, and after having laid out these rules in the most hierarchical manner, a manner that bespeaks its monotheism in its counting to seven and its sabbatical seventh sentence, of that which one cannot speak, one must therefore remain silent, proposition seven, and the only unelaborated major proposition of the Tractatus, is that logic is not only not enough, strictly speaking, but that one must find ways, and that this is a potentially infinite task, to describe and understand the ways in which language and thought, languages and thoughts operate, take place, are used, etc. There is no one way to do this, except that it must be done at every instant, in every responsible ethical utterance, in every thought as a way of life. And this way of life, quite an impossible one, but one to which Wittgenstein lived up to every day. Russell always said of Wittgenstein that Wittgenstein told him he thought of committing suicide every day. And this way of life, whether solitary or not, takes place in a world with and among others. For this reason and many others, Ludwig Wittgenstein remains a significant other who lives on in what he showed in his saying. Thank you.
I just want to talk a little bit about the way I and a couple other writers have used Wittgenstein in our writing. I started out by being fascinated by the Tractatus and was determined to write a novel that would have the same structure. There would be seven central sentences. They would be the centers around which all the rest would gravitate and in a logical or, if not, hierarchical relation. Well, you'll not be surprised that I was not able to write this novel. it was not a form that accommodates the mess, which is what Beckett says the contemporary artist has to find. however, I want to mention a great novel that did succeed in something like this, and this is the German poet and novelist Johannes Bobrowski wrote a novel called Levins Mühle, 34 Sätze über meinen Großvater. Levins Mill, 34 sentences about my grandfather. It's a novel about anti-Semitism in late 19th century Germany, northern Germany. And when I saw this, I was both delighted and, of course, jealous. You know, how does he do this with these 34 sentences? Exactly what I wanted to do. But as you read, it's a wonderful novel. And if you want to identify those 34 sentences, you run immediately into trouble. And it's quite clear that he was having fun with the idea of a sentence, that he was playing with it. I just want to read you the first one in an English translation. The Drewens is a tributary in Poland. That's the first sentence. And right away I hear, so your grandfather was a Pole? And I say, no, he wasn't. Already, you see, there's room for misunderstanding, and that's a poor start. Well then, a new first sentence. On the lower reaches of the Vistula, on one of its minor tributaries, there was in the 1870s a village populated predominantly by Germans. All right, this is now the first sentence. But you would have to add, and then there comes a whole slew of other things. And it goes on like this. And just, for instance, at the close of the introduction, he says, and now the action begins, the second sentence, as it were. So you get the idea now the whole action is becoming the second sentence. And it goes on like that. He constantly plays with the idea of what is a sentence, which sometimes is very wide and sometimes very small. But he does always pull up to the surface the sentences he thinks most crucial. So I'm still envious of this, but I recommend it highly. So I give up on my novel and the logical structure, but I kept reading Wittgenstein. And I kept reading both for the fact that he investigated language, that he thought about language, which is what I was doing in my poems too, and maybe mostly simply because he writes beautifully. And I don't quite want to go as far as Marjorie and say he's a poet, you know. But on the other, well, she says it with a pinch of salt, of course, you know. But I must admit that I read him the way I read poetry and the way I read literature. You know, I read him for the pleasure of the sentences rather than their philosophical significance. I savor both detail and composition, both the rhythm and the dance of his intellect among the words, and you'll notice I'm quoting Pound's definition of a kind of poetry. And above all, what brings him closest to poetry in my mind, which is he rarely puts in all the steps that a pedestrian logic would require. He takes leaps, he condenses, and which, of course, again, is that we've already mentioned this word, is condensing is also called dichten, which is the word for poetry. And I think actually that this quote that we've already mentioned twice, that philosophy dürfte eigentlich nur dichten, that I think it's correctly translated as it should be written as a kind of poetry, but as an overtone, I think there is this way it should be written as a manner of condensing is also there, in the German at least. It, of course, in the English, you have to decide one way or the other. No. But again, Wittgenstein does not, to vary one of his statements, Wittgenstein's philosophy, even though it aspires to the condition of poetry, is not used in the language game of writing poetry. And mostly the words are instrumental for him. They are in the service of clarification, which is not what poetry is after necessarily. You all know this famous quote, "My propositions serve as elucidations in the following way. Anyone who understands me eventually recognizes them as nonsensical when he has used them as steps to climb up beyond them. He must, so to speak, throw away the ladder after he has climbed up. He must transcend these propositions, and then he will see the world aright." The world aright, sorry. A poem is not such a ladder. It is not exhausted and superfluous once it is understood. On the other hand, again, and you see I'm perfectly between two stools between Sissy and Marjorie, on the other hand, again, I would argue that Wittgenstein's writings are also not to be thrown, that he's too modest here. They continue to give pleasure. They are also to be returned to repeatedly, and they feed the imagination. The way they fed me is by the incredible combination of the logical or philosophical argument with a language which, as he says, uttering a word is like striking a note on the keyboard of the imagination. And I have used, I have written a trilogy of books called Curves to the Apple. And they are all, they could be considered a kind of write, what we call now writing through Wittgenstein. This is somewhat parodistic intent. I am constantly pitting the body against the logic, which makes for fun, you know, especially the female body. But I've shamelessly stolen from him the syntax, the vocabulary, often phrases, and very often I've just let his phrases spark something, and they constantly did. I want to read you just a very short little example. For instance, I read in the Philosophical Investigations the phrase, "Why does it sound queer to say, for a second he felt deep grief?" It's a very funny sentence. You know? I was delighted when I came on that, and I said, I can do something with that. You know, and at the same time, there was also in my head something from another part where he says, "To say this combination of words makes no sense excludes it from the sphere of language." And somehow these two things were in my head and came out then finally as this. It's a prose poem. "My love was deep and therefore lasted only 1 second, unable to expand in more than one dimension at a time. The same way, deeper meaning may constrict a sentence right out of the language into an uneasiness with lakes and ponds. In language, nothing is hidden or our own, its light indifferent to holes in the present or postulates beginning with ourselves. Still, You may travel alone and yet be accompanied by my good wishes. More recently, it's been the preponderance of questions in Wittgenstein that has fed me and has stimulated me, and I have been using them a lot, and I found that's a perfect way of having my cake and eating it too when I use it for metaphors. So I can still have metaphors in my poems and yet at the same time sort of draw attention to that I don't really approve of the old cliché that identifies poetry with images, you know. So, you know, I would do things like, we lean toward each other and don't know what will come of it, like an electric charge. If you do not look at your feet, you begin to sway, as in a gale, etc., you know. But I want to skip, I don't want to read another whole poem, because I want to end with the sort of my most remarkable encounter of Wittgenstein in another poet's work. I was translating a book by a French poet, Jacques Roubaud, Quelque chose noir, something black. The book is an elegy on the death of his very young wife. She died at age 31 of a pulmonary embolism. And the second poem describes her, as I suppose he found her, lying on the bed with her arm hanging down, her hand hanging down beside it. The poem begins this way. The door pushed back the light. I knew there was a hand. Who could from now on grant me the rest? Having seen, having recognized death, that it didn't just seem, but was, there was certainly no sense doubting it. Having seen, having recognized death. If someone had said, I don't know if this is a hand, I could not have replied, look closer. No language game could budge this certainty. Your hand hung down from the bed, almost warm, almost, still almost warm. It must have been the word language game that made me reach for Wittgenstein again and start browsing. And what I had thought the most intimate exclamation of pain was right at the beginning of the book, Uncertainty. First sentence of Uncertainty. If you do know that here is one hand, will grant you all the rest. Number three, if someone says, I don't know there is a hand here, he might be told, look closer. This possibility of satisfying oneself is part of the language game. It is one of its essential features. This is Wittgenstein talking about G.E. Moore's proof of the external world. I was stunned, partly because what I had thought was most personal was actually a quotation. And I was also amazed by the absolute literalness with which Roubaud used this, so that what I usually do, like turning it in some way, or for instance, Mimi Bersenbrugge, she usually transforms her quotes from Wittgenstein into metaphors or into foils for her metaphors. This was so literal, and so it turns G.E. Moore's proof, his philosophical postulate, into a concrete physical body, and all the rest into the whole person of the beloved. And this is an amazing thing to do. And, well, I quote it not only because I think it's great, but also, in a small way, a very small way, partial way, it is an answer to Wittgenstein's whereof one cannot speak, about that one must be silent. Whereof we cannot speak for emotional reasons, because it touches us too deeply or too painfully, we may be able to speak through the distance of another person's words. And in this case, the words of both G.E. Moore and Wittgenstein. Thank you.
I was glad to hear something of the French Wittgenstein, because there's also been this tradition that is not so well known. And I'll begin with this kind of joke that there is the American Wittgenstein, and it would be Stein, Gertrude Stein, is already contained in Wittgenstein, and it is a certain type of poetry that is meant, and Marjorie and many others have explored the affinities or convergences or parallelisms between Gertrude Stein and Wittgenstein. There is a British, perhaps Wittgenstein, that took the Witt or Witz in Wittgenstein, and you can think of Derek Jarman's film with strange Martians, speaking animals, neo-Dadaist questions, and so on. And then there might be a French Wittgenstein with the gun in the middle, had left, which is sort of the first sentence of the generic,
the generic
Stein, generosity, universality, which sends us back to that question of, are we in fact discussing ideas? Are we discussing words? Are we discussing languages? So the question of translation or untranslatability of Stein is at issue here, and Tom and Marjorie mentioned that. How to translate Stein? We know, and if we follow my idea of the American Stein in Wittgenstein, there is also Pound, and you mentioned Pound. Pound alerted us to Dichten equals condensare. I'd just like to read the context of the passage that we all quoted. It should be read in German. I can do it. But in order to understand that when Wittgenstein mentions the idea of Dichten, that he underlines, I think I summed up my attitude to philosophy when I said philosophy ought really to be written only as poetic composition. Bad translation, but it must, as it seems to me, be possible to gather from this how far my thinking belongs to the present, future, or past, for I was thereby revealing myself as someone who cannot quite do what he would like to be able to do. And I insist on this, because and this is the last element I would like to throw. Even if philosophy should be written like poetry, in many, many notes, Wittgenstein seems to deplore the fact that he cannot do it. And this is why I think he's so exciting. And here I might surmise this idea that if we compare Wittgenstein with another philosopher writing in a very notoriously untranslatable German, like Heidegger, we have a philosopher who indeed writes philosophy like poetry, hence the quasi-impossibility of translating Heidegger into English or French and so on, but maybe the possibility of reading him better in English or French. Or in philosophy, in poetry, we could think of René Char, the French poet who was really so close to Heidegger, who tried to write poetry like philosophy. It's not what we have with Wittgenstein. Precisely because he's so close to everyday language. In that sense, I would suggest perhaps that Wittgenstein is the antidote to Heidegger. And he would be very close to Freud. I believe, for instance, that Wittgenstein, as he said, only at some point, that he was a disciple of Freud. He would be a Freud without the Freudian mythology. So I'm not sure that whether this fits with your interpretation. If you, I think we have gone a little over time. Then we really want to have time to engage with the audience, but maybe each of you wants to respond to what the others have said? Or
later, probably.
Or should we just, yeah, we could immediately.
I just want to make a remark, as I'm interested in words. The etymology of dichten is from dictate, and not from to make it dense or to condensate in German.
Yes.
That's very important.
It is important.
And if I may make one note about that sentence which you reminded us that we all cited, constructing the group after the presentation of the members. When I heard the various translations, all of which I cannot keep in my head at once, of that sentence, the most important to me about some of the paraphrases of it into English were that they left out the fact that this is the infinitive of a verb. And they made it into a noun or into a noun phrase. And I think that we must insist on and stress that Dichten cannot simply be made in... It is not Dichtung. It is not a thing. Yeah. It is an activity. So. And it seems to me that if you miss that, if you miss the verbal instance there, you miss the sentence.
I don't think it's missed on that. Just as another one is David Atkins, which says you can only do philosophy as poetry. But I want, may I say something about the last part when you talked about that concern everyday thinking of suicide brings me back to the poetic, and of course I said that purposely. I'm well aware that Wittgenstein did not write poems and is not a poet in that sense. I mean it in the broader sense, the way we sometimes say Plato was a poet. What I mean by it, let me just make that a little clearer, is the same Wittgenstein, who did keep always the rope handy so he might commit suicide, said famously, and I take this very seriously, at the end of his life, tell them I've had a wonderful life. Yeah. I love that statement, and I think it was absolutely true. I don't think that's apocryphal. He meant it. Tell them I've had a wonderful life. Well, how can somebody who's about to commit suicide every day also feel he's led a wonderful life? Well, this is the mystery, and it's the paradox. And I think you have that sense of unresolvedness, which is what we think of today so much as poetry, in Wittgenstein, which is not, I think, a characteristic of what we usually think of as philosophy. It also interested me that you said that you don't like the way people define philosophy, that they've defined it too narrowly, but you do evidently feel poetry can be defined.
No.
You see, in a way, because it's the same thing. I mean, you say, oh, they define poetry, they won't allow this to be philosophy, but can't we therefore also allow it to be philosophy?
May I correct a small misunderstanding? I think the philosophers are the more rigid and stiff ones, and therefore they deserve the criticism, whereas the poets have a better sense of what they do and don't try to rigidify themselves too much.
But I just want to say that the sense of paradox is, for instance, there's the famous statement in the Tractatus, death is not an event in life. Death is not lived through. And that's often quoted. Well, in fact, that's not true. That's not exactly a wonderful aphorism. Death can be talked about. Other people's death. It isn't an event in my life, but everybody has had death in their life in knowing of other people's death. So strictly speaking, that is in fact not true. You know, Wittgenstein makes statements like that, and then he may very well make a statement on the next page that's really rather different, where he revises it. And that often makes people very anxious. That's what I mean, that it's more like poetry, because if you take it as what we normally think of, at least, as philosophy, then you become very anxious because it is not always followed through on. I also want to say something about critical edition, and this may be a slightly, I hadn't really thought about this, but I do believe this. I agree completely, for instance, that the translations, that's a whole can of worms. The translations are very problematic of Wittgenstein. But the fact that there's no critical edition may in a way be a good thing yet, because Wittgenstein, after all, was claimed by the British as a British philosopher. And that's how most of you know him. You know him in English. Because he was in Cambridge, he's considered a British philosopher. And the British really feel they own him. I mean, they're editing all those. They've just brought out the new edition of the Philosophical Investigations. And even in Kirchberg this summer, which is, after all, in Austria, believe me, the British dominate and they run the show. The analytic philosophers run the show. Now, it took quite a while to realize that, wait a minute, he wasn't really a British philosopher. He's Austrian, you know, which is rather different. And, of course, the German editions come later, mostly in many cases, than the English editions. So you have somebody that nobody's quite sure where he's from or what he is. And then, of course, most of the things we know are the lectures, the things that are taken down by other people, and we're not quite sure just how accurately they're taken down. So we're not quite sure whether what we're reading is what Wittgenstein actually said, and Rush Rhys took it down, whoever took it down, Elizabeth Anscombe. So that complicates the picture. That has given a kind of opening, though, so that people all over the world, I think, feel that Wittgenstein can belong to them. And that's what struck me so much at the International Symposium this last summer, which is the first one of those I went to, where I have never been to any conference on anything where there are people from so many different nations, from Nigeria, from the Azores,
from the Philippines, whatever, all people who think, at least, that they're very interested in Wittgenstein. I don't think, you know, if you had a critical edition, it would be then, now we have the critical edition. So I think for a while the Nachlass is being worked on, it may be well not to have a critical edition yet. And what they're working on now is what Wittgenstein himself says at the preface to the investigations, that he thinks it's just an album, that he thinks maybe this book is just an album. And so somebody sent me a book recently in German on that issue where he tries to make a case. It's somebody who did this as his PhD thesis. I'll just mention it. Making a case for it being like almost like a photograph album. I didn't think of it an album in that sense. But said, it's really just this book didn't really come out the way I liked. As it ended up, it's just an album. And that's very interesting to think about. And there are people, as I say, in Bergenau that they're working on these aspects where they're trying to figure out how you put the things together, which is not so easy. So I'm not so sure there can be a critical edition. Yeah. I don't know. I've never really.
Well, I think of what the people in Bergen and what Klaus Liefeld and Peter Krebs and so on are doing as critical.
Because
if they have 20 different ways of recording a point on a piece of paper, whether it's a colon, whether it's a multiplicand, whether it's an and, whether it's a period, etc., more power to them. To me, that's a critical edition.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
So maybe we can. I saw. Yes, a question.
To Cece, you used a locution English does not allow, and I wish you would explain that. English does not allow, you said, to poet.
To translate.
You said there English. You said English does not allow, and I don't understand that.
No,
she didn't say that.
Yes, you did.
It's that the verb. You know,
I understood that. You said English does not allow. I'm going to your words.
So I said nonsense. But I don't think I said it.
She meant there's no English word. You did. You said that there's no English word for the word.
No,
the
I verb. Understand that. Yeah. What I don't understand is English does not allow. But she is retreated. That's fine.
No, I didn't retreat. I know what this is here. It's not allowed. You cannot say to poet because it's not existing. You can invent the word to poet.
Well, don't we do that? Anyway, go on.
No, but the grammar doesn't. It's not existing in the Wortschatz. Am I right?
Well, it's even more that Dichten in German also means Dicht, as in Dichtung und Wahrheit, to invent. To imagine something, to create, and there is no comparable word in English that covers, right, Rosemary?
That covers all of those.
Language not allow something, that's what I'm asking.
Well, you can invent to poet, of course.
Yeah, that's a philosophical question.
Yes.
You're right.
No, good, yeah.
Read down the Vegas.
Metachodos,
And so it's not that it's not, it really is, in fact, what Martin's describing about his method of trying to bring words home to their ordinary use, and in that way of going into the verticality of the language as well as into its horizontality, he is poetized.
I agree with you if you go back. But I also want to recall the fact that in Koine, metahodos has already slipped into metodia. And if you look at the entry for metodia in Little and Scott, it will tell you ruse, deception, error, particularly used for the extraction of taxes. the problem is not. In a certain sense, with the fact that the etymology of method is itself to be upon the way, but rather the fact that when we say method, many of us, in many circumstances, have forgotten that. So that method can be flexible, yes, of course, but
When that's why I think the use of the word doctrine is a more hard on hard and fast use, reminding one of church doctrine and so on for rigidity than method. I accept your point.
Mm-hmm. Bruce? I'd like to follow up on that because I wanted the Pepper Perloff negotiation on this because it seemed like the difference in the way you were using the word method was crucial to how you were seeing Wittgenstein, whether you were seeing him as someone who had poetic potential or whether you were seeing him as somebody who could be territorialized back onto doctrine. And then the mediator then would be Rosemary talking about even if there is a method that you could discern. I mean, method to me, I'm thinking scientific method, right?
Sure.
Where there's not a predetermined end. The whole point of scientific method is to develop a protocol of verifiability to tell you where you're going without knowing it in advance. Knowing it in advance to me would be doctrine. So if Rosemary's saying, well, here's this method being laid out without a predetermined end, which would be fascinating, and we can learn from that as poets, perhaps, and what's intriguing about it is what's left out, then that opens up, that's what's opening up for the reader, and then we've got what's left out being, I'm reading, weirdly, this afternoon, footnotes to Schiller, where they're talking about the mistranslations of him using the word abstract in the German, which I don't know, as extract, and they're saying there's an alchemical subtext to abstraction, to also condensation, and it has to do with the transformation of the person at the other end, which would be the opposite of doctrine. That would gesture toward the reader. The reader could be self-transformative in the process of tracking this method, precisely because it's open-ended. It's not all shut down. It's not all detailed at every point. It's not mimetic. It's not reproductive. It has this opening out, which is, I'm assuming, what Marjorie's talking about, is the poetic part of it, not doctrinal. The opposite.
I certainly never said it was doctrinal. I said just the opposite.
No,
trying to suggest that the Tractatus is written as a hierarchical book of doctrine, even in the sentence about the latter, whereas what takes place over teaching is not. Furthermore, I think that what you said about science in terms of a method of discovering what is undiscovered is itself somewhat of a travesty of science, inasmuch as science, too, as so much of the last 50 years of work in the philosophy of science has revealed, is very much often involved with seeing as. That is to say, you have an intuition which, in fact, you're not looking for the unknown. You're confirming a hunch that you've already had. And I do not think that we can idealize as such in terms of for or after either science or poetry or philosophy by virtue of such hard and fast kinds of things. And this is what I meant when I said, when I remarked that the Tractatus and the investigations were, according to Wittgenstein's testament, to be published within the same covers, which they have never been in English. But Klosowski did, I think, in the first French translations, and they are in German, right here. The point is that he wanted them to remain in tension with each other as the two sides of a coin, which are not separable from each other, that not to be reified, not to be method, anti-method, but as a work where they stand in conversation with each other, just as Nobel Prize-winning experiments very often come to people in dreams, which are, as we know, a grand locus of Dichtung and Verdichtung.
On this final point, I'd always thought that the reason that Wittgenstein thought it would be a good idea for the Tractatus to be published together with the investigations was not that he somehow thought of them as equal you know, equally valuable and understood in relation to each other, you know, both on par, but rather that he thought of the Tractatus as a kind of flawed first draft to what he really wanted to get at.
I think that's true.
I mean, he says in the preface of the Investigations that he came to see grievous mistakes in the earlier work, and so he thought he would be in the best position to see what he really wanted to get at if the earlier work were there, and then one could, you know, go into more easily see what's wrong with it. And he spends the first part of the Investigations telling us what's wrong with it.
Yes.
So that's one thing. But actually, my main thing that I wanted to say, my sense is that something is getting left out of the picture here. I hear it said that it's been suggested that Wittgenstein's work, his philosophy, is essentially poetic. That there's no conclusion, that it's more a way of thinking with no real end in sight. The way I see it, there is a very, very clear conclusion. There is a very clear destination specified in advance, namely peace, internal peace. The solution to all philosophical problems. The idea is there that, as was suggested, that in a way traditional philosophy is some giant mistake and has to be got rid of. There is philosophical perplexity, there is philosophical puzzlement, but in some sense that puzzlement is illegitimate. A kind of intellectual therapy, bringing us to Freud, is needed in order to understand the sources of the confusion and get rid of it. Wittgenstein sees that as the end, and it's not just the limit of some infinite series that, you know, it's kind of medically impossible for us to ever get there. Of course, it's difficult and complicated, but there is that destination. There isn't a single method, as he says. There are various therapeutic methods that are important in order to get us there. Perhaps the way in which he writes so beautifully is one of the tools that is deployed. But I don't myself see... He does write beautifully, and I don't see it as an essential component of his central philosophical ideas.
But what you call a terminus ad quem, that is to say, the point of peace, of achieving peace, I view as a limit function. That is to say, something which is not achieved or achievable, but has to be at every instant, which is why I use the Kierkegaardian locution, worked at. And this is, in a certain sense, parallel, as Jean-Michel suggested, to his Zeitgenosse, his temporal comrade, Freud's, question of interminable analysis. And to you I would repose the question, one, why do you speak of merely poetic with such derision? That would be one.
Okay.
And two, more importantly, there is a sense in which the Investigations as a book suggests in the words of the parable of the Good Samaritan, go and do thou likewise. It is a teaching book, and it has an ethical aim, which is to say, keep on going and doing this. And that is what we are enjoined to from the citation of Augustine on the first page, as you well know, obviously. So I don't think I said that Wittgenstein was essentially... or merely poetic, far from it. I said that he belonged to him, that his moment was the moment at which the war of philosophy with its own language achieved a certain acme, and that that's probably why we are, one of the reasons why we're all here. Because it continues to achieve. It's not achieved.
So, yes, question.
I'm not a scholar, but I absolutely related to the transposition you did between the poem and the text, that deep second that doesn't exist. I love that line, and I want to thank you for making it very clear. What I was thinking about was a similarity between this philosopher and Rumi, who also gave language to the listener, didn't write it down like the couch, wandered around and appealed to a great many diverse, to this day, we're still listening. And I think that the heritage was just so fascinating. The Jewish culture assimilated, changed to Christianity, the wealth, like Siddhartha, that was walked away from, the wandering in the woods when he was a young man and teaching sort of in the village, and then ending up in some British empirical institution gazing at the ceiling while people wrote his words down. And then, as Marjorie said, the conferences now exceed nationality in a major search everywhere for peace, contentment, or the acceptance of anxiety, that nothing is solved, it's simply read over and reinterpreted. And your story about your first line to that poem made that transition so clear, because poets read for poetry. So whether it's a definition of poetry or philosophy in the sense, like Rumi, you're looking for something that's contained in a text that crosses all kinds of borders.
Well, thank you. But it's true, he's quite extraordinary in how many people he has been able to feed in this way. If you look at Marjorie Perloff's Wittgenstein's Ladder, she has a whole chapter about contemporary poets that obviously take off from him.
Yeah. More than philosophers.
Yes,
right.
That's perhaps the paradox.
Yes,
yeah. So.
I mean, the question of the cure or of coming to peace or coming to rest poses the question. I think the most important thing that I have to say to you, sir, is okay. But the question is, if we're to put it to rest, and if that's the goal, we also have to ask ourselves, and Wittgenstein does, why does it keep coming back?
Yes.
Again and again and again and again.
And this struggle, there's a great deal of struggle. It would be nice to think there's peace, but it doesn't. I mean, there always is. If he had lived longer, then he would have rewritten half these things again and gone over them and said, this isn't right, I didn't get it right. Now, of course, there are constants. You know, we don't want to make it look as if it's just endless revisionism. And by the way, I think the discussion about method, we're just hair splitting, I think we agree completely. It's a way of proceeding. For him, it's a way of moving on and a way you can proceed. And the negative, we haven't said enough perhaps about the negative thrust. Often people think if there's a negative thrust, well, that's not enough. But the negative thrust is terribly important. It's what you can't say. And it's not a matter of just silence, but it's that you learn you better not say certain things because they're really silly to say and wrong-headed and lead to lots of problems. So that, in fact, when he says, what's the use of studying philosophy if it doesn't teach you how to live your everyday life? That, to me, is absolutely central. It does become a way of living, you know, more than anything else. But I'm not sure peace is quite the result, because on the contrary, there's always going to be further struggle. He always will get angry at somebody again and say, this is a ridiculous notion. And incidentally, I heard a very interesting thing this summer that I had never heard before, which was that when he was writing the Investigations, that was when he was in love with Francis, right? Francis, my mind is a blank. But his particular friend at Cambridge who died, and that he was the kind of muse. They've now found many papers at Trinity College that show that this was written for Francis. I don't know why I can't think of Francis's last
name. Skinner.
Skinner, thank you. And and that when and that Francis was a kind of muse, and that much of the direct address was sort of for Francis, who was used as the muse, and that when Francis died, for a while Wittgenstein couldn't write at all. He didn't want to lecture because he said, I don't have anybody to address it to now, and I have to rethink and regroup what the kind of address is going to be, which is an interesting way it ties in with Lubow. We could do something, you know, with that. But and then, of course, he sort of recouped that idea. But the very idea that you have to address somebody, somebody specific, somebody you know who acts as that kind of, you know, is going to be the person, you know, who acts as your interrogator is a very was a very interesting thing to me because he always had to then do it over, and there would be somebody else and somebody else to convince or maybe not convince. But the main thing to learn is how not to waste your time doing things that aren't going to work. For instance, throughout his career, Wittgenstein says early on, I think in lectures 31 or so, that he does not believe in meta-language, as opposed to so many philosophers. There's no meta-language in Wittgenstein. There really isn't, as opposed to Freud, as opposed to Heidegger, as opposed to just about everyone. And he sticks to that pretty well, unless you think language game, and that's not much of meta-language. There is no, he did not believe in meta-language, ordinary, and he says, ordinary language is all right. Ordinary language is all right. So, and that goes all the way through his work. Already in the Tractatus, when he's talking about tautologies, and, you know, all right, so analyzing tautologies, it's either reigning or not reigning, so on. And then he moves into all these very strange philosophical statements, ethical statements that are very surprising, that sort of come suddenly after some white space, and then you get these statements, these strange statements. The answer must be outside the world. The sense of the world must be outside the world, all these sort of mystical statements. But there is no meta-language, which makes him very different from just about any other modern philosopher, where you're busy learning what the terminology is and so on. And that's a whole other thing that is interesting, because so all I meant by poetic, again, in that way, is that in poetry, as I would see it, context, of course, is everything. Where, not using a certain word, but where it's used, and what the context of the thing is, and you always have to look at it that way. And that is very true in his philosophy, because you don't have those meta, you don't have any meta language to fall back on.
And certainly, if you follow the doctrine of what is stated in the Tractatus, the words of the Tractatus Logico Philosophicus are not meta language, because they have no meaning at all, because
that's
they don't refer to any state of affairs.
That's right.
And that would be true of his reading of Freud, to go back to that. He follows Freud insofar as Freud has no meta-language. But whenever there is the architecture of concepts and so on, when S becomes more than a pronoun, then he thinks it's a mythology, which is completely right.
But we would also have to get rid of some of the Wittgensteinian mythologies.
Right.
That's a question.
There was only one work in the literature about Freud which distinguished between method and doctrine, and that was written by Dalbiez in 1936. So my question is...
By whom?
By Dalbiez. Very little known. It's called The Psychoanalytic Method and the Freudian Doctrine.
And who is the author?
Dalbiez.
Okay.
Roland Dalbiez. Few people know about him, but it's a classical work. So my question to you is, what does Wittgenstein's method, how does it help us to understand Freud's method?
You do that. Right. That's how Jean-Michel.
I think I would agree that it's not a method in a traditional sense. That is, that take what Freud says about dreams when he discusses Freud, he takes one dream, one of his dreams, or one of Freud's dreams, and then he makes sense of it more or less, and at times reaches a dead end. And so it's a way of using Freud to understand himself, I think, and also understand language and the differences between images in dreams, images in real life, and so on. But what he does is cleansing Freud, as it were, as he cleanses himself of the superfluous notions that would precisely be the bad Freud to me, or, you know, the American Freud, that there is the sort of struggle between the poor ego, the id, and the superego, the ridiculous Freud that we don't want. See, so this is where his method is very efficient.
D'après Lacan.
Well, we are, but I didn't want to use Lacan because you don't need Lacan for that.
No.
You just Wittgenstein, I think, has really seen very well what is at stake in Freud, and had one read Freud with his strategies, maybe more than method, you would have avoided, you know, the capitalization of S, id, ego, and so on, which I think is always the side of the mythology, the doctrine in Freud. Here I'm a little, I don't know whether you would agree with that.
May I come back to the question of war and peace, and maybe perhaps both would be better replaced by a word such as struggle. And to a comment I remember, but I cannot cite literally, it's from the Remarks on Color, so it's roughly contemporary to Uncertainty at the very, very end, the last few weeks of Wittgenstein's life, because has stayed with me for almost three decades. It goes something like this. Imagine someone who looks at a Rembrandt portrait, and particularly at the pupil of the eye, EYE, in the painting, and says, I should like the walls of my room to be painted this color. That's it. Now, that's an explosive, that explodes to me, the notion. I mean, that's a that is a device. That's to me, that's a bomb that says, that speaks about precisely what he's trying to investigate, the language of color and color language, and how contextually dependent, how aspectually dependent it is. I do not see, however, how that remark could be stripped of its tension, of its explosive character, and be of any use for us. Because to me, I won't say this is what the remark means, but what is being brought into play is the question of something in chiaroscuro, so something in a set of relations to other depictions of light and dark, being spread out as a monochrome blank surface, and almost saying, how ridiculous. And yet at the same time also saying, I should like the walls of my room to convey the Stimmung, or the mood, of the pupil of that eye, all at the same time. And so I don't see how we should... we can try and make peace with it, but ultimate peace, again, might be death. And that comment about that Marjorie cited from the Tractatus, it's extraordinary because, of course, one of the things that England becomes a topos of a problem for is a certain kind of ahistoricization of Wittgenstein. That's a citation from Lucretius, Book 3, line 969. It's the same line that Claude Lévi-Strauss, may he rest in peace and may his name be praised, puts as the epigraph to Triste Tropique in his dedication to his son. Do not fear death for, etc. I rest.
Any other question? Yes?
I'm interested in Thomas Bernhard. Could you maybe talk about the influence of Wittgenstein on Bernhard?
I could say something about Thomas Bernhard's play, which refers to Wittgenstein. You know this? It's called Ritter Dene Fosse. And he takes biographical stuff the two sisters and a guy named Wittgenstein called, I think he's from the family Wöhringer somewhere. You know it better, probably. But he takes biographical stuff, material, and puts it into his Bernhardian way of bringing thinking and talking into a strange relationship. But that's a biographical work. And there's this other work by Bernhard Wittgenstein's Neffe, as you know, and The Corrections, as I know, Die Korrekturen.
Singular, Korrektur.
Korrektur, Die Korrektur. Who a guy is building a house for his sister, which is again referring to the life. And on the opposite is Wittgenstein's Mistress by David Markson. He's not taking any biographical material. He's just doing the thought, how Wittgenstein puts sentences and thoughts together. But Bernhard, you know better than me.
But for me, the great novel would be Korrektur.
Yeah.
Because this is really the novel in which Reuthammer, who builds this strange house for himself, and also the house for the sister. And so it's really Bernhard creating a sort of fantasy of a very Austrian Wittgenstein, one might say, with incest, the absolute, the cone in the middle of the forest. It's very dramatized. And at the same time, it's one of the novels in which he experimented with this style of endless repetitions and narrators narrating texts. And
it's about a kegel. What's a kegel?
Sophie Wilkins translates that as the cone.
The cone.
And the sentences are really built like a cone. That's very interesting.
But you see,
so the language structure, what is performed in the contents and vice versa.
But what I think Bernhard saw in that novel is the little discrepancy we may experience about what we know of Wittgenstein as an architect in this single building house that he built for his sister, purely modernist, with every detail perfect. He had to make, a change of 3 centimeters to the height of the ceiling, and the mass of the texts. And so what Bernhard, I think, caught was this idea of the Nachlass, the endless sea of fragments that cannot be classified. And so his style is running between the two, as it were. Mm-hmm. Like to understand.
Also, in Wittgenstein's Neffe, and Woodcutters, which is what in German?
Holzfäller.
The whole thing is one monologue, the wonderful party monologue that goes on all evening and getting drunker and drunker. And the repetitions and the use of words where again and again, for instance, in Wittgenstein's Neffe, where they're in the sanitarium, Stichent of, I forget the names of the streets, Der Wasergasse und der Andergasse, and those are going to be modulated endlessly again and again, and every time take on a slightly different air. What's going on between those two people and what you surmise. On the other hand, you know, I mean, nobody's ever totally coordinate. Bernhard, who was such a wonderful writer and certainly has been featured, there was one of the first things here at the Austrian Cultural Forum was a Bernhard exhibition, is more skeptical and more cynical, you know, certainly than Wittgenstein. I mean, it actually would be interesting to compare them. I have a chapter in my book on Bernhard and Bachmann, but I won't say that. But when I think about it now, I do think that, and that's where Wittgenstein is so strange, different from most people. He is not, I mean, Bernhard everything is treated skeptically. There really is sort of nothing. And actually, Wittgenstein doesn't really feel that way, you know? I mean, it's not that there are answers, but they're the right questions to ask and the right way to live and the wrong way to live and the good art that is herrlich, like Mozart, art that is terrible, like Schumann, you know. And, you know, Wittgenstein always had very strong opinions. So in that way, he isn't like Bernhard. You know, that's already a later period. I think there we have to historicize us a little bit that by the time Bernhard comes on the scene in the post-war, which after all Wittgenstein didn't really live to see much at all. It's a very different mood, don't you think?
I think he's an important case in point, since we were starting off on Wittgenstein and poetry, and there's also Wittgenstein and prose, after all. And I think you make that point in your book that Bernhard started as a poet and abandoned poetry. His poetry is not fantastic, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
But he found his way, I think, through Wittgensteinian, I'd say. Here we can go back to the idea of the method with Frost, and so in which you always have a thinker who is a little crazy, who lives in seclusion, and a disciple who tries to make sense of what he has to say. And that then generated a strange verbal machine that has been compared by some to a virus that some writers caught because it's so powerful. But I think it's really in depth to Wittgenstein, quite simply. Yeah.
I would like to add something about Correctur to what Marjorie and Jean-Michel just said, and that is that, of course, the I voice, the frame in Correctur, which one very often loses sight of, is the amanuensis, that is to say, the one who is trying to sort out the laundry lists after Reuthammer, the philosopher, is dead. And I think, as Jean-Michel just put it about the way Bernhard makes use of Wittgenstein and used the word disciple, it's very important to understand Correctur as a novel about the resentment of what it means to be a slave. That is to say, the person who is the narrator is being driven crazy by the Nachlass, and just mimetically, in a false identification, as he finds that the philosopher Reuthammer, as Reuthammer moves toward his suicide, crossed every single word of his own corpus out. Mm. And therefore, I would say here we have a case where Bernhard's deployment of the topoi from Wittgenstein and so on are indeed very anti-Wittgensteinian, because Wittgenstein, he may have created some slaves, but he certainly did not wish to create slaves.
First, I want to thank you for a most interesting discussion. And since you brought up Wittgenstein's nephew, I'm the niece of the nephew. I'm Sylvia Wittgenstein.
Okay. I was going to say that it was just a reference to Diderot, so I see that there is a real basis.
By the way, one practical comment. Next year, in fall of 2010, Ritter Denefoss, the piece of Thomas Bernhard that you just mentioned, is going to be brought to the United States for the first time to La Mama Theater by a Canadian production company. And we're going to support this. So this is going to happen in September, end of September 2010. And I think it's a very, very... I think it's one of, if not Bernhard's best theater plays. It's marvelous,
it's
and
funny.
It's about, and it's very humorous, yeah.
Okay.
So I think we can close the discussion. Thank you very much for your participation.